Hey guys, this is Nicholas Brown and welcome back to another episode of the Second Sticks podcast. As you may have noticed, this will be the first episode I've actually released in over a month. Since March, I've been working full time, so unfortunately, I no longer have as much free time to record episodes, but I am back this weekend with a new episode for you. My guest today is Paul Daly, Director of Photography. Enjoy. I am here with Paul Daly, Director of Photography. How are you doing, man?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little tired, just after last night, but yeah. Making it work. So what is it that you do? So you're a Director of Photography. For people that this is maybe the first episode they've listened to, what does a Director of Photography do?
It's an easy question. not easy to answer. Succinctly, I would say it's your job to get that image that's in their minds being the creatives on the screen.
Right.
To do that, you've got 100 people who are all pushing in the same direction. I suppose your job is to organize that and get that moving in that direction.
Yeah.
Someone's got to lead the charge, really.
Right.
And that will be you, I suppose.
Right. So you're really in charge of more than two or three departments and making sure that the image that we get as a consumer is as beautiful as possible and matches with what the director wants and way they want it to look.
Yeah, that's the goal. That's when it starts to get a little more complicated though, because you can only shoot what's in front of you. So that's when your production designer comes in.
Yeah, right.
You can have all the ideas in the world, but if your key grip can't implement your genius plan, all it is a genius plan.
Right.
Your gaffer's got to be amazing.
Yeah.
You've got this light and plan in mind. He has to be able to do that. So it's really, it's you, but it's not you. It's everybody.
Right. It's always a collaborative effort.
It so is. Someone has to be pointing and giving the orders, but
it's up to everybody to implement the actual action. Yeah. Okay. So what got you interested in working in film in the first place?
Let's see. I never had a burning desire to do it at all. I was dating a girl that worked at a production company and I was working in construction and I went to pick her up from work one day. And as we're walking to the car, someone ran out and asked if I wanted to be in a commercial.
Like as an actor?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I said, yeah, you're going to pay me? They said, sure. I said, all right, yeah, I'll be there. So I turned up to do this AT&T commercial. And as soon as I opened my mouth, I had this English accent.
And they were like, ooh.
They're like, ah. So they had to dub the whole thing. I was probably the most expensive bit part actor known to man.
Yeah, but the person that asked you to be in the commercial, when you opened your mouth to say, sure, I'll do it, didn't they hear that you had an accent?
Presumably not. I don't know what they heard.
That's funny.
Yeah, so what happened was I did the commercial and I was watching everybody work and I talked to the director afterwards and said, look, I don't want to do this, but I know I could do that.
Right.
I was watching the guys run up and down ladders and what have you. So he talked to somebody and I got a job filing tapes in a post house.
That's cool.
And that's where I started.
That's where it started. And then how did you transition back onto the set?
That post house had a studio, a little like an insert stage. So when I'd done my tape filing duties, I'd go in the stage and just noodle around with the lights. And
okay, so you learned.
Figure out what was going on. And then little productions would come in and I'd hand out business cards. And I got myself on a feature as a best boy grip. I knew nothing. But I got.
Sometimes it works out that way.
Yeah, and I got on the job as a grip, and that was it, really.
Nice. So then I know you used to be a gaffer, so you became a best boy grip, and then you transitioned into being an electric, and then made your way up that way.
Yeah, I was. Well, I was actually not a bad grip, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. I was really interested in the lighting.
Yeah.
So the plan was get there, see what you want to do, and then go from there. So lighting was where it was at for me. So I became an electrician. A non-union gaffer, and then it became my goal in life to get into the union, get into Local 52 in New York, because that was like the pinnacle.
Right.
And that's what I did.
Yeah.
You know, you take the test, you do the vote, you do all this stuff, and eventually I got in. It took me years, but I got in and then worked as a gaffer in New York City and Los Angeles for 15 years.
Oh, wow. And then how long did it take you to transition into, like, when did you decide that, oh, maybe I mean, like, obviously you're a gaffer at that point. You're like, when, maybe I should become a director of photography. Was that part of the plan? Like,
no,
once you became an electrician? Okay.
No, it wasn't. I couldn't see anything beyond being a gaffer on big movies. I just thought that was the, nothing's better than that.
Right.
I couldn't see anything better than that. I was so consumed by it. And one day I was on a movie and I'm working away and the camera, I'd lit the set and the cameraman came in and started to make changes and I got really resentful.
Ah, okay.
And then I saw, there was a moment, I was like, you're going to be one of those bitter old men if you're not careful. You're going to have to, something's got to change because they're not going to change. So that's when I decided.
I'll be the guy that wants, that can come in and make that change right. If I want it to happen.
Yeah. I sort of remember the moment. It was strange. I went from being unbelievably content to not.
Right. That's kind of a good thing though, because it's a personal growth, you know, in a way.
I suppose it was, yeah, you could, that is a one positive spin on it. The other spin is I was just miserable.
Okay. Yeah. That's another way of looking at it. Yeah, the way it was for you, I guess. But, so what do you consider like, so you're doing construction. When did you finally, what was like your break-in moment when you completely transitioned to film? Was it the best boy grip job or?
Yeah. I transitioned to film absolutely immediately.
And you never went back?
No.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. There was no going back.
There's no dilly-dallying around and coming back and forth between jobs.
Nope. That's what I did. So, I mean, I PA'd, I gripped, I'd do absolutely anything.
Oh, did you work as this? Okay. So you didn't jump straight into just being a full grip, like grip. You just worked in film, whatever position.
Yeah.
You
the do, phone, you know, the phone doesn't work that way. The phone rings. I would take whatever came up.
Yeah. And it was smart.
Try and point the boat the direction I wanted to go, but I would take almost anything.
Right. So your original, like basically your original long-term goal was to, you know, you want to be a gaffer and then that wasn't really what you wanted anymore. You're a director of photography now. Is that, I mean, is there, do you have aspirations to direct or is it, are you kind of at the point in your life where you're happy?
Yep. No aspirations to direct, but you know what's going to happen. I'll be standing there, come up with all these ideas and the director's going to say he wants to do this. And I'm going to be angry about it.
Yeah, and then you're going to
so
go.
Then I'm going to want to direct. That's what's going to happen.
And I'm sure the opportunity will arise at some point.
Yeah, I hope it does. So. I hope it does.
That's funny. So maybe directing, but as of right now, no aspirations
just fully focused.
To direct. Okay. So what are some cool projects that you've worked on?
Oh man, that's a good question. I guess it depends on who you're talking to. I did a couple of really cool jobs. I spent a month in the Sahara with the Tuareg Nomads.
Really?
A documentary. Yeah. I shot an intertribal camel race that they'd organized to stop them fighting amongst each other.
That's awesome.
So I did that. That was cool. I did a job in Hawaii on, I think it's Mauna Kea, that volcano, and it went off.
While you were there?
Yeah, when we were there. So I had to pick up the generator with a helicopter and all that kind of stuff. That was
That's
cool.
That's wild, dude.
Yeah, that was neat.
You don't get that from like a desk job at all.
No. Yeah. There's been some pretty cool world travel stuff.
Where do these jobs come from? Because I never get called for these documentaries in Africa or anywhere cool, man. I'm trying to go, you know, all over the world.
Yeah. I got really fortunate. I shot a couple of overseas documentaries and I shot one that won Sundance.
Oh, really?
And I sort of became that guy, the documentary guy, you know, I go all over the place. In fact, I was in a bar in New York City, my local bar, having a beer, and a guy walked over and said, "Are you the guy that shot God Grew Tired of Us?" I said, "Yeah."
Wait, you shot God Grew Tired of Us?
Yeah.
With John Dow?
Yeah.
I've watched that in a theater in my college and met John Dow. I had no idea you shot that. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Dude, it was awesome. It's a great documentary. I had no idea you shot that.
No one's going to believe that. Everyone thinks you just made
100, it. No, there's a picture. If you're friends with me on Facebook, there's a picture of me from like 2010 with John Dow.
Oh, wow. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that.
It's a fantastic film.
So I'm at this bar. Oh, thanks for that. I'm at this bar and this guy walked over and said, "Oh, you shot God Grew Tired of Us?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh, I've got this film in mind about Mexican cowboys." I said, "Yeah, what you got?" He came up with this cockamamie story. I was like, "All right." And he called me. A couple of weeks later, there we are. We're flying through Mexico and we land in central Mexico. And I spent sort of months there following cowboys around.
Mexican cowboys just like ranchers?
No, what they do is every year there's a giant what would you call it? An exodus? A parade with tens of thousands of these cowboys. They ride to the geographical center of Mexico to a Christ on a top of a mountain, Cristo Rey, they call it. Huh. And they take mass. So they ride for weeks from all over the place, get there, take mass, and they all go home.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's nuts.
You show a documentary about it?
Yeah.
Man, that's cool.
Yeah, and they just drink and shoot guns and go mad. You know, it's great. I had a great time.
Oh my God. So you've been all over the world for film.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really fortunate. Crazy. I've been everywhere.
I'm jealous, man.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate.
So I heard that you have a story. All I know is that you have a story about working on 9/11 or being near the towers or something. What is your story?
Well, I was in the tower. There were studios. It was Morgan Stanley had studios. So I had this great corporate gig, like once or twice a week. I'd go and light up CEOs and they'd talk and then they make videos and send them presumably to their branches. I don't know what they did. Right. But it was a great gig. So 9/11, I was in the studio, the 44th floor of Tower 2, in the studio with my friend, the gaffer. I was shooting it and my friend was the gaffer. And all of a sudden we heard this, this rumble. It wasn't that loud, but a rumble. And then this overwhelming stench of aviation fuel. Like diesel fuel, and that's paraffin.
Yeah, right.
I was like, what's that? I look out the window, all this paper's falling down. I was like, well, this is really strange. And then all of a sudden, big lumps of stuff's falling down. And then somebody who was a lot more intelligent than me said, why don't you get away from the window?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, yeah, good idea. So I get back in, and I said to the gaffer, why don't we get out of here? Let's just go.
Yeah. I love how you sound like you're saying it all nonchalant. Like,
well, it was. That's how it was. Well, nobody knew
how
significant it was. And so I said to the producer, what do you say we go? And he's like, yeah, no, we are. We're going to leave. I said, all right. So I went back in the studio and I turned the lights off, headed to the elevators. And everybody was sort of heading for the elevators. And then my friend, he's like, oh, I left my stuff. And I said, well, leave it. We'll get it later. He said, no. And he ran back in, got his stuff. He left mine, but got his. We start walking to the elevators. I'm like, why don't we take the stairs? Even though it was 44 floors.
Right.
So he's like, all right. So we're down. We're walking down. And a tannoy comes on, a loudspeaker comes on. And the person says, go back to your offices. The problem's isolated to the other building. The emergency's over type thing. So I'm sort of walking and I just said to the producer, nobody knew. So I said to the producer, I tell you what, why don't we just go downstairs? We'll get a cup of coffee. You go back up and we'll go back to work later on. Make sure it's all fine.
Right.
It was just this really off the cuff decision. He's like, yeah, do that. And if he had said, no, let's go back to work, I'd have gone back to work.
Yeah.
So we're walking down, get to the bottom. Everybody's calm, very cool. It's a very orderly exit, so to speak. I'm heading toward the main exit, which, if you remember 9/11, they called it the tombstone, the last piece of the building that was standing. It was all backlit and burnt. That was the exit I was going out of. So there were two sets of doors, revolving doors and sort of flapping doors. I got out of the revolving doors and I was just about to go out of the main doors when that building I was in got hit. And then all the debris started to fall down. So people ran out and I turned around and ran back in, which was another good decision.
Right.
At that point though, my friend Joe, he went into the fetus position and then people started to panic and I left him, which I felt subsequently awful about. I just assumed he was going to get up and follow me.
Right.
So I just ran and I ran into the crowd and it was amazing. It was like the part of the sea. People just moved. I didn't touch a person. It was really strange. I didn't have to barrel anybody out of the way or anything.
Well, it's because was everyone looking up?
Oh no, everyone was in the building panicking.
It
was pandemonium at that point. All the decorum went out the window. People were absolutely going berserk, freaking out.
Right.
You can imagine. It was that moment, everybody knew exactly what was going on.
I was going to say, I have to assume within a minute or two of the first tower getting hit by an aircraft that people would have known. That's what I'm confused about. Like them coming on the radio and said,
they thought it was, everybody, well, my group of people, the assumption was it was a tourist helicopter, something like that.
Okay,
just a tragic accident, but right. a one-off accident. And nobody had anticipated two 737s.
Right.
So anyway, I turn around and I run, and I knew because I've worked in that building for so long, it was a maze down there. It's about an acre. Each floor was an acre. It was huge. And you kind of needed to know where you were going, otherwise you wind up in a big circle. So I come around a corner and I'm running down an alleyway and there was a security guard there. And the guy started to jink from one side to the other, you know, sort of tackle me. Do you know what I mean? I just went past him like he was standing still. And then sprinted. I was going to sprint to the A train. And my plan was, if there's no train there, I'll just run down the tracks.
Right.
Just get out anywhere. You know, I've never done that before, but presumably you could stand up against the wall if a train comes in. That was my plan, you know. So I was sprinting toward the turnstiles and there was a policeman standing at the turnstiles. He was about 100 yards away. And I was just really sprinting. And the cop probably didn't know what was going on either because their radios didn't work down there apparently. And he just saw me and just opened the turnstile. And boom, I went through that.
Wow.
Went around the corner and there's the trains. And that time, I think it was the A and the C, I can't remember. But I always remember that there's one train always sits there at the station. I used to call it the tourist train. And they would get on it and it would sit there for hours. And I don't know why, but it just did. And then the other train
moved?
Would always go back and forth. Yeah, it was really strange. I don't know, it was some MTA debacle. And there's people sitting on that thing. And I just ran past that. And on the other side was a train with the doors closed, ready to pull out. So I just ran next to it. And I thought, whatever, if it leaves, I'll just run behind it. And it shunted the doors, you know, where they open and close the doors. And I got my hand in there. And then it started to shunt the doors and he wouldn't let me in. So I just incrementally started moving my body in and the people on the train were screaming at me to get out. You know, I just wanted to leave.
Right.
So I got in and I held the doors open and a guy ran in behind me, underneath me. And he said he'd been following me the whole way, this guy. And then the doors closed and the train pulled out and I got off at Spring Street, which is, I don't know, five stops away, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, 5 minutes, and watched it fall down.
That's so crazy, man.
And then I went back on the bucket brigades. I went back digging. I volunteered. So I went back, you know, in those bucket brigades, you're digging.
Yeah. That's so wild.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. I remember when that happened, I was in Washington State and it was like 6 in the morning or something. And I remember looking out my, you know, I woke up after the first plane hit. And I remember looking out my bedroom into my parents' bedroom and their TV was visible. And I watched the second plane hit like live.
Yeah.
And I was like, what in the fuck is happening?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It was very much that.
And then we still went to school and we just watched the news all day at school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when I was digging on those, you know, bucket brigade things, The reason I went is because I was in the union. They had all kinds of volunteers, but they only wanted union people. I guess they wanted to keep some sort of control over people that were down there.
Yeah, right, right.
So I put this big respirator on and I'm digging and I look down and there's a massive hole in the ground and the train that was sitting at the station was still sitting there.
You could see it?
Yeah, sitting about 50 feet below me, all smashed up. It was there. I was like, oh, I see. And then that tombstone, they call it the tombstone, that corner of the building was the building I was exiting. It was the only piece of the building that was still standing.
That's so crazy, man.
Yeah.
That is a wild story.
Yeah. What happened?
So crazy. That's like a movie in itself. Not that, you know, but it just plays like a movie, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all of a sudden it was like 18 years ago, 19 years ago, something like that.
So weird. Well, thank you for telling me that story.
Yeah, I got loads of them.
So tell me the hijacking story.
Right. Yeah. Now this was in the late 90s. So you're going to have to forgive me on some details. I can't remember all of it, but basically it was this. I was flying from Charles de Gaulle back to New York. And we're flying, it was Continental, we're flying Air France, that much I remember. I remember seeing Jamie Lee Curtis at the airport and being really excited. Get on the plane, it was an overnight thing, and it's like midnight and I'm really bored, you know, so I go into the galley where all the stewardesses are. So I'm hanging out with the stewardesses, having a few beers, you know, we're chatting away, and it was like four stewardesses And one of them said to the stewardess, I don't know about 19B. She's like, yeah, I know. I said, well, what's the problem? She's like, I had this guy, he's talking about going to the cockpit. He's acting strangely. And this is all pre-9/11, remember?
Yeah, right.
So you don't think a great deal of it. I said, all right, well, you got contingencies for all that, don't you? She said, no. I said, oh, well, if he does something, you want me to do something? She said, yeah, if you don't mind. I said, no, fine. And I thought,
what?
I thought that'd be the end of it, right? So, you know, we're a couple of beers in, everything's going great. And then there was this huge hullabaloo, like people screaming and yelling.
Right.
So there I am in the galley with the stewards and the stewardesses. We've established that this guy's
sketchy,
behaving strangely, but not much more than that. So then there's a commotion, some yelling and some screaming, and the stewardess goes running around the corner. And I can't remember if she called me or something, but I ran around the corner too, and there he was. He was tall and skinny, yelling and screaming. So I stopped him and I just said, all right, mate, take it easy. You know, just stop. So then we started fighting. And then all these flashes were going off and people were taking pictures.
Of you fighting?
Fighting this guy. Nobody helped.
Of course not.
So we were just fighting. So we fell across a row of seats, miraculously empty, I suppose. I think, yeah, it must have been. And I got him down and then the stewardesses, not the stewards, the right. stewardesses jumped into action and they tied him up with the seatbelt demonstration.
Oh, nice. Dude, that's awesome.
Which I thought was really clever.
Yeah.
So then I've got him in this sort of half-assed chokehold thing and they're tying him up and he's yelling and screaming. And this lady came over. She said, I'm a doctor and you've got to give him air. So I told her to fuck off. So we're not giving him air. And then at that moment, the plane dived. It was like a movie. It was a 747 and it dived, dropped to the left and went straight down. And we landed in Bangor in Maine at a military airport. And it was cool. It was like a movie. We landed and there were the black FBI cars driving along next to the airplane. I was like, oh yeah. But while all that was going on, while we were landing, people are buying me drinks and I'm getting, it was great. You know, this is great. So we land and then the FBI, presumably the FBI, just run in. They grab this guy and he was gone. It's like he was never there.
Yeah.
But what that meant was they have to take all the luggage off the plane.
Right.
Everything's got to be searched. Everything's got to be sniffed. All that stuff. So we're going to be in Bangor for some time. So I get off the plane and you just walk across the tarmac and there's like a, it's not a terminal, it's just a room really. And CNN are in there, all those people. So I'm flying back to New York to get on a plane to fly to LA to start a movie. I'm going to miss the plane.
Yeah.
Obviously. So I call the office and I was like, hey, you better hijacking? They're like, yeah. I said, that was me. They're like, get out. I said, yeah, I'm going to be late. I'm not going to make it. They're like, that's great. And then the secretary was like, we're calling Howard Stern. I'm like, yeah, call Howard Stern. So it was really funny. So then I'm like, oh, great. This is my moment. So I wander back and, you know, there's cameras all over the place and reporters. And the chief steward chick who tied the bloke up said, hey, listen, not for nothing, but you've had a few beers. So why don't you take a powder on this one? Maybe don't start talking about it. You're a little banged up. And I was like, all right, yeah, okay. You know, fine. So I sit down and people are pointing at me and I was like, all right, well, you know, I get my name in the paper at least.
Yeah.
And the next day, I think it was the whatever news, but the Bangor Press or the Buffalo Times, whatever newspaper it was, 7 men suppress hijacker.
What?
That's what it said. Yeah. 7 men suppress hijacker. Not a word. All I got was a bottle of red wine from Continental Airlines.
That's all you got?
I had some sway with stewardesses for a couple of years after that when they got on the planes though, because they thought that I must have gone around in stewardess circles. What happened? I'm like, you hear about that? That was me. They're like, oh, really?
Yeah, that's funny.
See, I never got bumped up, but I get free alcohol.
Well, I'm calling you 007.
Yeah. So that happens.
That's funny, man.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. But it's pre-internet, so you can't really find it.
I know, right? Yeah.
You know, like 90s, AOL wasn't even around, I don't think. So you can't really research it. Somewhere I've got the newspaper.
That's cool though.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a great story and it happened.
Actually something else happened. I was, when I, after 9/11, I was working at Shea Stadium, organizing supplies and stuff to be sent down to the pile.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm working down there And all of a sudden, the Mets came out. They were practicing, presumably. Bobby Valentine comes over. He was the manager of the Mets. He's like, what are you doing? I said, I'm putting together first aid kits. He said, you need some help? I said, sure. He goes, Benny, come here. So he sent Benny Agbayani over. Because I was into the Mets at the time. So me and Benny are putting these together. And then Bobby Valentine's backing in 18-wheelers and shit like that. It was really cool. I was like, oh, this is great. So anyway, I did my day. I'm driving home and the phone rings. And this bloke says, it's Paul Daly. I said, yeah. He said, I'm Billy Smith from the Buffalo Times. Are you the same Paul Daly that stopped that hijacking? I said, yeah. He said, oh, great. Can we have an interview? I said, yeah. I said, oh, someone heard about it.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's great, man. Yeah, you're like a spy.
Well, not very good. Everyone knows who I am. That'd be a useless spy.
Well, that's true. But still, you got some cool stories.
Yeah. All right, there you go.
So you kind of fell into film. So did anything about the business surprise you? Because I like studied film. Went to college for it and wasn't like physically or emotionally prepared for what it was really going to be like. Was there anything about it that surprised you coming from? I mean, I'm sure the hours on construction jobs and stuff are probably pretty similar, but like, was there anything about the business itself that surprised you when you got
there? Yeah, I couldn't believe that the absolute dedication that was involved, how each craft was so focused, pointed in their craft. It was really interesting.
Right.
And I wanted to be a part of that. It was sort of like being in the army without being in the army.
Yeah. I feel like that's part of the reason why there's so many great filmmakers, because if you spend, it's kind of like, it's hard to explain, but like if you're working on a student film or something with like, this guy's going to do four jobs and that guy's going to do four jobs. Mm-hmm. It's like the quality's going to lack somewhere, because you're like, when you're working on a professional set, this like the director has his job, the DP has his job, everyone's, like you said, so focused. And they trust everyone around them to do their job so well. Mm-hmm. That's why the quality's so good.
That's right.
You know, it's like, it's just a master class, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, some people could be good at five or six things, I suppose. Right. But I mean, you don't ask a basketball player to play football, do you?
Exactly.
It's just, they're both athletes, but let's face it, it's not going to work.
Right. Is there anything else surprise you?
The hours, the carnage that it creates with people's private lives and personal lives, and have the same old story, the divorces, that kind of thing. That did surprise me. It took a little while to get my head around that.
The hours is the reigning theme for answers from my guests on this show.
Well, it's a dedication. You have to be 100% dedicated. If you're halfway in and then you're not in at all, don't bother. It's not going to work.
Someone that I work with, you know, Justin, you know, back when I first started, you know, some people say like, oh, people that work in the entertainment industry, they don't really do anything and they get paid a lot of money to do it. It's just like, you're getting paid too much money. It's like, what? You're really getting paid because you're away from your family for so long. Like you know what I mean? It's like, you basically have to give up your life, your personal life.
Yeah. That's one thought. I mean, my thought on it is, you're paying me for what I know, not what I'm doing. If I'm sitting down, it's because you're asking me to sit down.
Right.
If you want me to light and shoot the scene, I can do that too.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I totally get it. Yeah.
It's the hours are the hours, and you're not running all the time, but you're there.
Yeah.
And you're focused and you're prepared to do it. That's how I would venture to answer that question.
That's a good answer. Is there anything advice-wise that you would give someone who's listening who wants to get into film and doesn't know where to start, or just any advice in general about the industry to prepare somebody that thinks they want to do this?
Yeah, I don't think there's any great mystery to it, and I don't think it's that difficult to get yourself involved in it. I do think that my suggestion would be that you focus quickly on the discipline that you're interested in. Don't meander and don't float around, because 10 years goes by so quickly.
Yeah.
You're nowhere. Pick a direction. And even if it's the wrong direction, it's okay, because you've learned something. You can always turn around and go the other way, but focus on something.
Yeah.
And the main bit of advice I would give, and this is going to sound so glib, it's don't get good at something you don't want to do, because that's exactly what's going to happen.
Once people start to, if you take a job as a grip because you want to be on a set, and then you get good at it, whether you like it or not, people are going to see you as a grip.
That's right.
And so if you have aspirations to do something else, it's going to be tough to pull yourself back out.
Well, just keep focused on what it is you want to do. I mean, no one, you don't leap out of the womb and become an executive producer. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So work your way up or work your way sideways, however you want to look at it, but just remain focused. And the other thing I would say, again, it sounds so glib, but don't have a plan B.
Yeah.
You have plan A. If you've got a plan B is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And if you have to have a plan B, it needs to be C plan A. That's the only thing I could say.
Yeah. That's how literally I didn't get a minor. I've told this story before, but I didn't get a minor because people, my friends in college were like, well, what if you don't work in film, dude? What are you going to fall back on? I was like, if I plan to fall back, I'll fall back.
That's right.
I'm not going to fall back.
It's not that complicated, is it? It's really
just
not.
Just stay driven.
Yeah.
And it'll happen.
And the thing with advice as well, it's useless because nobody's career path is the same. There is no
right way to do it.
Yeah. They just
it's isn't. The right way for you.
Yeah. My suggestion would be turn up and work for free. That gets you in the door and away you go.
Yeah.
You don't have to be the best technician. You have to be the best anything. All you have to be is the hardest working. If you're the hardest working, you'll always work.
Right. Okay. So I heard you went on a date with Britney Spears. How did that happen?
It's true. I was the gaffer on a movie called Crossroads. So it was a vehicle for her, you know, it was her movie. And she'd just broken up with Justin Timberlake. And I don't know how old I was. I was probably like 30, something like that. 28, 29. I don't know, something like that. It makes her about 19, I think. So I had to really pick my moment, you know, because she's wired all the time. They've got minders. It was the height of her
like fame.
Maniacal when she was success. Like, right. It was madness, the stuff that was going on around her. So a band was playing. I think it was Widespread Panic was playing. So I got a couple of tickets, got the tickets first, then sort of wandered over to her, picked my moment, and the mic was off. I said, oh, hey, Brit, hey, got a couple of tickets to a show in town. You fancy it? She said, what is it? So I told her. She said, yeah, sounds good. I said, great. Leave it with me. I said, all right, work's done. So I walked over to her bouncer, a minder. I remember his name now, Mike or something. I said, oh, Mike, got a couple of tickets for a concert. I'm taking Brit. I've only got two tickets. You can't come. Is that cool? You know, sort of. He's like, no, absolutely not. It's not going to happen. I said, she can wear a hat. He's like, no, it's not happening. It's not happening. I was like, oh.
So that's the story about how he had to buy a third ticket to.
So I go back to her. I said, so Brit, Mike, whatever his name was. Maybe it was Steve. I said, Steve, Steve's put the kibosh on it. He said, I can't take you out. She said, all right, leave it with me. I said, all right. So I thought that's going to be the end of it, you know. So we're working in New Orleans. We're shooting away. It was like 10 o'clock at night. We wrap. And I'm, you know, putting my meters away or whatever. She walks over. She's like, you ready? I said, yeah. All right. I didn't even ask what for. I was like, yeah. So we jump in a black car. We drive to like the French Quarter. It wasn't far. It's like, you know, a few hundred yards.
Yeah.
And then there's Steve standing outside this bar, standing at the door, guarding it. So she and I go in and they've emptied the place.
What?
So it's just me and Brittany and Steve and this bartender. And he's like, what can I get you? He's sort of looking at me like, what are you doing? I was like, have a beer, please. And she gets like a Shirley Temple or something with fruit in it. And you know, I'm like, oh my God. And she's like, so? And I was like, yeah, so you know, what do you talk about? And this is not what I had in mind.
Right,
I was woefully unprepared for this moment. So I made some small talk. I got my beer down my neck and she's like, are we done here? I said, yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I'll see you tomorrow. I said, all right. Yeah. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that was basically what happened. Yeah, it was sort of a kiss on the cheek. And
that's funny.
Yeah, see, so it worked.
But you didn't get to go see Widespread, man.
Nah. I think I gave the tickets to my best boy or something.
Oh, that's funny. I wonder what bar it was. I was in New Orleans.
I was too, and I looked for it to see if I could find it again, but it was all such a blur. You know, my head was spinning. I was like, oh my God, here I go.
I came to your set, but you were very busy, so I didn't say anything.
Oh, you came to Crossroads?
No.
Oh, on Power.
No, yeah, on Power.
Oh, that movie. Oh, okay.
I was there in October.
Oh, yeah. That was Yeah, that was a busy one. Yeah, so that was the Britney Spears story.
That's amazing.
Yeah. What I would like to say, which I think is not appreciated, and I mean this, I don't mean this in a, you know, that false modesty way.
Yeah.
But the team, the crew is such a, I don't know that term crew, it's a weird word, right? But the people that we work with are so talented. It's kind of humbling.
Yeah.
You know, and we have a production designer, Richard Wright. I mean, you know him as well as I do.
Yeah.
When I don't know him at all. I just know what he does. I mean, that man is so supremely talented. The stuff he pulls off, I don't know if you've really noticed, like the minutiae and the detail that goes into what he does. And I know it's such a cliche, but all I got to do is point the camera at it, put some light on it. It looks unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, the man is brilliant. We got, you know, I focus too much on our job, but we got a rigging gaffer who is so good that his rigs, you can point the camera at it. You can look at the truss work. You can look right at the cable, and he's laid it like corduroy.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. The pride he's taken in his work. You know, he's like a 65-year-old man who attacks the job with the same gusto that I would imagine he did when he was 18.
Yeah.
He's just absolute dedication. A rigging grip that free climbed to get truss up in that rave scene we did.
Oh, really?
They had to free climb to get the pick points. And it occurred to me when we were shooting that scene, I was looking around, that if they'd have done 70% of what they did, it would have been perfectly acceptable. There was no need to go that extra 30%. Absolutely no need. And they did it. And it was, well, the scene was wildly successful.
It was.
Because of the rigging grip and the rigging electrician.
Yeah.
And his boys, obviously his people.
Right.
And it's just so overlooked.
Yeah.
You know, you just sort of see the cameraman with his beret and his cravat and his monocle.
That's part of the reason that I do this whole thing too, is it's like there's so many people that work on a film. You know what I mean? And it's like the director gets their light and, you know, the DP and the, you know, everyone. It's like there's hundreds upon hundreds of people that work.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't ever get to hear their story.
No, you don't. I will say though, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there is an implicit understanding that everybody understands how good everybody else is. Otherwise you wouldn't be standing there. I think it's sort of understood. It's just never really recognized.
Yeah.
Which I think is a little unfortunate, but I don't know. How do you do it? How do you recognize that? Yeah. But our work environment is, I think, incredibly unique. We have phenomenal people. And everybody's into it. Even when people are not into it, they're into it.
Right.
And I don't know that there's any industry, I don't have a great deal of experience in any industry outside of this, but I don't know that anybody else gets to experience this kind of dedication.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. And again,
when you're at hour 18 and you're pissed off and you're tired and you're still there.
We're just still going. Then you turn around and you see the dolly grip picking up a 400-pound dolly, you know, half of it by himself, laying track. You're tired.
Yeah.
Oh, because you've been looking at an eyepiece. You know, 400-pound dolly. It never stopped. I never forget it.
Right.
You know, I look, I'm like, how hard do you think it is? Look at this guy.
Yeah.
You know, Phil Dan, the dolly grip, he's unbelievable.
Yeah, he's phenomenal.
Man, he's a force of nature, probably the best dolly grip in certainly this hemisphere.
And he's also just a super appreciative person too, which is great.
He loves it. Happy to be there. Happy. Yeah. He's just a great guy. And again, his key grip, his boss, Lee, phenomenal, great guy.
Yes.
Yeah. And you have to be careful because you take it for granted, because you know yourself, you show up on a film set and it's just a miserable experience. Nobody's getting along.
Right.
Things don't gel. And that's an entirely different experience.
Yeah. That's why I feel like luckily in the Southeast, our crews, we're all so tight knit that everyone just, it's like a big giant family. You know what I mean?
And yeah.
If the butting of heads happens just with like situational, but like it's never anything serious.
But it's passion.
Right.
You have an opinion and that person has an opinion and someone's opinion has to win. That's all that is.
Yeah.
I've got no problem with disagreement.
Right.
It's healthy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It sounds so trite and cliche, but man, this crew is, Best crew I've worked with in the last 10 years, only because I can't remember much beyond 10 years. Did
you? You didn't forget about Britney Spears,
no,
though.
No, I didn't forget that.
That's funny. Well, I think that's it, man. I just want to thank you so much for doing this, man. I appreciate it sincerely.
Yeah, as soon as we put these things up, I'm going to think of all kinds of stuff we should have said.
We can come back to it.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks again for tuning in to another episode of the Second Sticks Podcast. As always, you can contact me via email at thesecondstickspodcast@gmail.com, Instagram at thesecondstickpodcast, or Twitter at secondstickspod. Thank you so much for all the continued support, guys.